We've been talking a little bit about unions and right to work today, and it's apropos because Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org, joins us now. Austin, thanks for coming on. We appreciate you.
Thanks, Annie.
So this is an interesting conversation to have because I'm talking to Illinois Policy about Missouri's right to work vote. Two things that I talk about quite a lot, just kind of a weird intersection here. But from an Illinois standpoint, watching the Missouri vote, state of Missouri vote on right to work and watching it fail, what's your assessment of that news?
Yeah, so there, if you're listening to kind of the union side of things, it is the best thing since sliced bread. It's this tremendous achievement. That's what the AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka called it. It's the sea change for unions in the Midwest. And in Illinois, it's a signal, apparently, that right-to-work protections for workers will forever be squashed in Illinois because of this this vote that happened in Missouri in the primary election. But in fact, really, when I think about this, and what I wrote about in my column was that if I was a rank-and-file union member and I saw my money, against my will, flow to this fight, I would be disappointed. The first thing is that it was extremely expensive. Unions spent something around $16 million on this one issue, this right-to-work vote in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
That's an extraordinary amount of money. The second is the way the legislature works in Missouri, it's going to be very short-lived. Could only be a few months, maybe just a couple of years that this will remain in place. And then third, it might even cut against other political priorities of the union. So even if you're a Democratic union member and you're seeing Senator Claire McCaskill down there in an extremely competitive race coming up, she's one of the most vulnerable Democratic senators in the nation, that's money that went instead to this fight rather than to McCaskill.
Yeah.
So I think all those reasons would be reasons to be skeptical.
I think that's a really interesting point because there was certainly, we've talked at length at the amount of money that was poured into this issue, and it wasn't even a fair fight. And, you know, it just kind of goes to show that the money talks. When it came to getting a no vote on Prop A here in Missouri, what do you think that what are the implications downstream from investing money in this primary Prop A vote and how that affects other elections that will be coming up shortly?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, the money question is really, really interesting because when you actually look at national polling data, most people are in favor of right to work because it's a very simple concept. It basically says, should you be forced to pay the union? Should the union dictate that relationship? Or should you be allowed to pay the union if you believe in what it's doing? And that's usually a very simple moral question for people, and usually they're in favor of right to work when it's polled nationally. But of course, you saw a defeat of the right to work measure in Missouri. So what's happening there? Really, it's when you have those kind of, we call it in economics, you know, concentrated benefits and diffuse costs. A lot of people, there aren't really a lot of private sector union officials or really strong union members in Missouri, but on this one issue, you better believe they're going to be pummeled 5, 6, 7, 8 times by the same message because of how all that money is coming in. So, of course, when that money is spent, you're going to see a different result than what public polling indicates generally for right to work. And that's exactly why it's so important that we have these cases in court that protect workers' constitutional rights when it comes to these types of things. Like we saw in Janus v. AFSCME, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole point is that the sovereignty of the individual rights should trump, you know, the majority will sometimes when it's those essential constitutional rights. And that's just what we saw in the public sector. No longer do government workers, for instance, no longer are they forced to pay for all the actions that their unions do for these types of legislative fights that they might be engaged in. But you're out of luck if you're in the private sector now in Missouri and the union says, hey, we want to spend $16 million ahead of a huge election on a tangential issue because we get this affects our pocketbooks, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a choice there.
Yeah.
And you should.
Yeah. That's, you know, the left is really big on choice, except for when they're not. And it's interesting to watch how they try to pick and choose how they're going to argue one and not the other. Another thing I wanted to highlight about this article here at illinoispolicy.org, it's entitled Missouri's Right to Work Vote, Boon or Boondoggle. You highlight how Eric Greitens, when he was governor, played into the union hands. Tell us about that, because I thought it was an interesting case, and I haven't heard anyone talk about it that way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that could not have been handled worse from a political standpoint if you're just talking about, you know, you're a pure Politico player. Any first-year lobbyist in Missouri would have said, hey, Governor, I know you want this really big landmark accomplishment when you're coming into office, but if you sign this thing immediately, you're basically giving your opponents a massive head start on trying to defeat you on this. And that's exactly what happened. The unions got months and months and months to gather signatures. And if there's one thing that a lot of unions are good at, it's gathering signatures for things.
True.
And they got that question on the ballot. And now, you know, I would be happy with that in Illinois, by the way. I would love some kind of citizen check on the legislature.
Yeah.
That was the first thing I'd love to see in Missouri was, hey, you know what, I might not agree with this ballot question, but at least you guys have a mechanism for kind of keeping lawmakers in place. We don't have that in Illinois. But, yeah, so he basically played into the union's hands extraordinarily with that. He could have only given them a few weeks to gather signatures, but instead gave them months and months and months.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, that same structure is in place. So next year, you will see a right-to-work bill bubble up. It's a debate on how far that will go.
Mm-hmm.
But you will see it next year, and they could very well wait to the last minute, pass that, and it'll be law of the land, and that $16 million will be for naught.
Yeah, you know, and you talk a lot about maybe a little bit of longing when you look across the Mississippi River and you see these supermajorities. It's just the opposite in Missouri with this massive Republican control in Jefferson City. How do you compare the way that Missouri has these supermajorities to the Senate supermajority in the state of Illinois, and the House is a pretty strong one? It's waned here in the last few elections. But how does that oppressive Democratic control in the state of Illinois end up hurting the taxpayers of Illinois on a regular basis?
It can be, I don't want to make it too partisan, but it's really interesting to think about, you know, in Missouri, even though they have Republican supermajorities in the state legislature and a Republican governor, there are checks and balances in place within the governmental structure that allows other interests to get a seat at the table. We might not like the outcome. We think that workers in Missouri should absolutely be in control of whether or not they pay the union. But hey, this was a massive reform that you couldn't even get with basically the strongest Republican legislature you could possibly have.
Mm-hmm.
Now contrast that with Illinois, and you have one person, the Speaker of the House, who has so much control over the legislative process that there is almost no room for any type of check on that power. And when we did a comprehensive analysis of all 50 states, there is no legislative leader that is more powerful because of the rules that are put in place in the legislature, because he is able to get referendum questions on term limits, on independent redistricting kicked off the ballot. There's very little citizen check.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing citizens would have is getting him out of the Democratic majority in the House. But that's a very tall task.
So is it the procedural differences in the state of Illinois actually give the Speaker of the House, not just specifically Mike Madigan, more power than, say, Missouri?
Absolutely. It could be anyone. It doesn't have to be Mike Madigan. And of course, you know, even despite how unpopular he is in Illinois, every 2 years, the Illinois legislature, Democrats in the legislature, reelect him to be Speaker and wield that massive amount of power. That structural advantage is huge, and it really plays into kind of this one-man rule that we have in the legislature in Illinois.
So in the event that we were to take 9 seats in the House here in November, a lot of those seats that are right here in the Metro East, right across the river, including my district, they're held by Democrats right now, but they're very winnable for Republicans. If the Republicans were to take 9 seats statewide and get the majority, that Republican would enjoy the same benefits as the Speaker of the House as Mike Madigan would right now?
Not all of them. You would have some of the House rules, depending on whether they are passed. I would hope that if another person were to hold that seat, Democrat or Republican, they would strip away some of their own power.
Yeah.
Because it's really bad for democracy in Illinois. But, you know, we got to think of the other things Madigan has in terms of his power. He's the chairman of the Democratic Party of Illinois. That's,
mm-hmm.
He wields an enormous amount of money. He's a huge property tax appeals attorney in Cook County, so he gets a lot of money that way. He has a lot of other sources of power as well. But absolutely, and even if Republicans don't take, for instance, all 9 seats, If they get close, I think we should definitely still keep our eye on that speaker vote, because he is a huge liability for the Democratic Party. And you might have some principled progressive Democrats stand up and say, hey, this guy's bad for the party. How about we pick someone else?
On a national stage, we're seeing it with Nancy Pelosi, which is kind of unheard of to see people go out and actively in campaign ads say, I'm not really for this Nancy Pelosi version of the Democratic Party. And, you know, I know state politics not being as grand stage as national politics is probably harder. And there's a lot more risk involved from what I understand when you come out and speak out against Mike Madigan. But everybody who does cast that vote for Mike Madigan is making a choice that isn't necessarily in the best interest of the people they represent, whether they're a Republican or Democrat. It would be nice to see people stand up against that.
Absolutely. I'm reading this book right now, for instance, on the old Daily Machine in Chicago. And the book is called Don't Make No Waves, Don't Back No Losers. Mm-hmm. And a key point of the book is that a lot of these people within the higher echelons of the Democratic Party at that time, locally in Chicago, they had no principles. The principle was, how do we capture and maintain power? And that really is sort of the Madigan model. He has very few. If someone says, you know, Austin, what do you think Madigan really wants on this issue? Why do you think he's doing this? The answer is always is never something about a political principle or an ideological principle or someone's constitutional rights. It's always about maintaining political power. And of course, you should have both Republicans and Democrats sort of standing up against that mentality.
Yeah, well, we're going to continue to watch it, because I'm very curious about how much ground the Republicans can just to level things out a little bit. But like you said, even if you don't get the 9 seats, there's still going to be pressure on especially those folks in the left to stand up and do what's right. So Austin Berg, Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. Thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Thanks, Annie.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye.